Welcome to You Are Not Broken, the only podcast that combines science, medicine, and psychology to re-educate your brain and help you live your best love life. And I'm your host, board-certified female urologist, Dr. Casperson.
All right, people, I'm so excited today. I have researcher Sari Van Anders, PhD, with me today, and she is a research chair in Canada. We're going to have to talk about all the amazing sex researchers being in Canada and why they left America, because I think that in and of itself is fascinating. But you've published over 80 papers dealing with gender and sex and sexual diversity, and talk a whole new lens of a way to look at sexuality is through the feminist and queer bioscience, which is absolutely fascinating and nobody knows enough about. So thank you so much for agreeing to talk to me today.
Well, thanks for having me.
I think I posted a picture of this paper, and the paper we're talking about today is The Heteronormativity Theory of Low Sexual Desire in Women Partnered with Men. So the paper, I posted a picture of it. And then I think like your neighbor said, like, our kids are in the same class and do you want me to introduce you? I think that's how it happened.
Yeah, it's a funny coincidence. And she said, people are talking about this. I have to connect you with this person I know. So, and here we are.
I don't know in the realm of the world if like people are screaming from the rooftops of this paper, but like I read a decent amount of academic texts about sexuality because this is my gig. It's what I do. And I'm like, this is huge. This needs to be like in the Wall Street Journal or something.
Well, thank you. I don't know if people are screaming about it, but definitely a lot of people, especially a lot of women, are really interested in what this is saying.
I think it's resonating. I think people are realizing like somebody's actually describing their lived experience in a long-term partnered heterosexual relationship. And they're like, oh my gosh, I thought it was just me.
I agree. I do get a lot of people telling me, oh my gosh, this is me. And then also some therapists who say, and counselors and psychologists who say, this is going to be really helpful with my clients. So because they see it in the stories of their clients.
Yeah. And I think, you know, just the name of my podcast is You Are Not Broken just comes from women over and over thinking that they're broken. And you're kind of saying like, no, this is like something that our whole society is struggling with, and back it up with like how it affects our hormones and how it affects our relationships and all of that. Can we talk about, like, I want to kind of, for the people who don't understand this, and I would include myself in that, but like, let's talk about gendered behavior for a quick minute. I think a lot of people don't understand like how we are socially gendered. Can you just kind of give us like a background so we can get into this?
Yeah, sure. So we often talk about sex where we think about things that have to do with like femaleness or maleness or sex diversity. And people kind of associate that with like genitals or voices or reproductive things, although there's lots of different ways to understand that. But gender, we think of sort of sociocultural aspects of masculinity, femininity, and gender diversity. And so when we think of like our lives as being gendered or there being gender norms, that means there's expectations placed on women to be feminine or to act in the ways that people think women should act. So there used to be lots of laws about this. For example, at one point, you could be arrested for wearing clothes of the wrong gender. And that was a bit of a time ago. And we know, for example, you know, women couldn't have credit cards without husband's authority and things like that. And those all have to do with gender, not sex. Not that sex is completely unrelated to them, but gender is sort of our sociocultural and learned ways of being, norms, structures, policies, laws, but also internalized. So how you feel you should be is not just something that arose independently of culture. It's also a reflection of, you know, the lessons we get from media, from family, from friends, from strangers in the street, from workplaces, and so on.
Beautiful. That's a really nice description, because nobody goes around being like, here's the 10 commandments for like how you need to behave. But it's all, we're kind of like absorbing it, right? Through like our families and our workplaces or our schools, or like Hollywood does, I think, a lot of rules about sex that we just kind of internalize.
Definitely. They come from all over, and it's sort of a constant little trickle that you might not even notice, but it's sort of the air we breathe.
Totally. Can you talk about how does being gendered as female affect our desire?
Yeah. So, well, I mean, there's a lot I can say about that. And I think I would say we were gendered as women or as feminine. And one of the things we're arguing Well, actually, let me take a step back. So in our culture, we tend to think of women as either being having too low desire, not having enough desire, or as being what is so-called hypersexual, so having too high desire. And typically that's because men are kind of taken as a standard. So women either have too low, and I put irony quotes around that, desire, because some men would like them to have more sex. Of course, not all men, hashtag not all men. And if women want more sex, then they're seen as sort of oversexed or hypersexual. And we see both of those things going on in the media, sort of these frigid or ideas of women who are, you know, not sexually liberated enough, or women who want too much sex, and that's dangerous as well. So our rhetoric and narratives in our culture tend to focus a little more on the low desire, I would argue, but there is that sort of too high desire relative to men.
I'm just thinking of like creating a meme of like the unicorn that doesn't exist is like the woman who desires just enough or like the right amount.
That's right. And desires the right people and in the right ways and at the right time. It's kind of like a Goldilocks version.
Right. Yeah. Like it doesn't actually exist. So that's amazing. So you were talking about, I'm just going through kind of like some of your past to like get you to this paper of like some aspects of sexuality widely assumed to be hormonal might actually be better understood alongside like the socio-cultural lens. Can you talk about that? Like we're just blaming all of our low desire on like estrogen or not enough estrogen or something like that.
And it's funny because I'm actually primarily a hormone researcher, but a lot of my research doesn't involve hormones. But the things I'm interested in, like sexuality, I kind of came to because so much of what we think about sexuality, we assume is hormonal. So, you know, when people talk about desire increasing around puberty, for example, that's hormones. When people talk about changes in sexuality over age, that's hormones. When people have high desire, that's hormones. And when they have low desire, people think that's hormones. And the hormone that I think people particularly hold up is testosterone, which is a hormone I mainly study myself. And so I got really interested because I was doing research on testosterone and desire. And though we're told in our culture, you know, high desire, high testosterone, if you increase testosterone, you increase desire, it's actually not really the case. It's much more complicated. And I started getting fascinated in like, what do we even mean by sexual desire? What are people desiring when they say they have high desire? Is that the same for women and men and people of all genders? And given these gender norms that we were just talking about, like sexuality isn't necessarily the same thing for everyone. So what are people talking about? And then once we know that, how are those linked to hormones? And often they're not actually. So instead we think, you know, and a lot of research points to the ways that our sexuality, even our own feelings, like even our own desires, our pleasures, are quite profoundly shaped by our social contexts, by our experiences, by what we think of as sexy or sexual, and so on. And so it's not that hormones are completely out of the picture, but the research suggests that actually, while they might matter sometimes, it's actually our sociocultural experiences and contexts that are a much bigger part of the picture.
I love it. And I think, you know, when you get into the like going to the doctor to get your hormones checked, our culture loves supplements. We love pills. We love fixing complicated things with simple solutions, kind of all of that stuff. And testosterone's kind of, it's in the discussion more and more because it is coming out as, especially for postmenopausal women, one of the only, air quotes, medical treatments for low desire. Where do you see the kind of testosterone and desire being used? How do you want testosterone to be used within the context of like a woman seeking help for low desire?
Well, I guess I would think testosterone would be, I would like testosterone to be more almost like a last resort. It's really, the research shows that women with lower desire or problems with desire don't necessarily have lower testosterone than other women. Research, especially with men, that shows for men with low testosterone that testosterone supplements don't directly increase desire. They increase things like energy or feelings of self-worth. And that is what seems to be playing forward into desire. So I get like, I don't know that it's so great what we used to have, which is people sort of, let's say, seeing like a psychiatrist week after week about what's wrong with them and their relationships with like their parents. Like, I don't know that that's the cause either. Mm-hmm. And I totally understand like, oh my gosh, a quick pill sounds really good. At the same time, often people find that's not really solving their problems. So for example, you probably know this well, that I think it was for a while, it might be more now, over half of Viagra prescriptions are not refilled. like whatever problem people are hoping these pills will solve, they're often not solving. And that's because the problem isn't usually a biomedical problem. On occasion it is, and I'm not, this is, you know, go medicine when medicine is the solution and when there's a medical problem. But when it's a problem with your relationship, testosterone isn't going to solve it. If it's a problem with our sexist culture, testosterone is not going to solve that. So it's not that I say no to testosterone, although the research suggests it's not actually going to work in most cases. It's more that I want people to be thinking about what is actually, you know, desire isn't just something that comes from in you, unrelated to who you're with or what your life is like. So the problems with desire, first of all, are they problems? Or is it just you have low desire? There's nothing wrong with that. Or if it is a problem, which it often can be, is it actually a problem with the relationship, with the context, with the stress, with the lack of sleep, with all sorts of other things? Now, I do want to say I'm not a therapist, counselor, or psychologist. So I'm a basic researcher. So I can't give like, do this or don't do this tips. Right. I wouldn't want anyone to take it that way. Yeah. But at the same time, our research really does give us a lot of leads to what we should be paying attention to for people who care about their desire. And I get that people do.
Yep. I love it. And I mean, I love how complicated the whole thing is, if that's even the right word, of like, it's not always just a pill, right? We just want a quick fix. And it's like, we got to look at the water we're swimming in, the relationships we're having, our thoughts about our body, all it's like wonderfully complicated. And that's what's so great about this heteronormativity paper is it really kind of pulls out all these pieces of it to be like, look at this amazing world we're in and how it can affect us so profoundly.
Thank you. Yeah.
So how did you write, like, why did you write this paper? What was the reason for pulling this all together?
Oh, that's a good question. I think because I do this research on sexuality and hormones, I see the rhetoric and the ideas and the assumptions that testosterone equates to sexual desire. And I was talking with two colleagues at first, and this was a long time ago. We started this paper a long time ago, I think over a decade ago.
Whoa.
Yeah, I know. Lori Brado, who's also a clinical psychologist. And
also
Debbie
in Canada.
That's right.
Yeah, okay.
Yep. And also Debbie Herbenik, who's also a public in public health. And so we had these different perspectives and we were discussing the research and the way the research is done and how it was really missing a lot of the things we thought mattered from public health perspectives, for me, from hormone and feminist perspectives. Well, we all do feminist work, but from thinking about gender norms and for Debbie, also gender norms and public health. And we started sort of putting it together. And at first we thought we'd write like a letter to the editor with like, here's some ideas. But it kind of grew and grew and grew. Then we put it aside for a little while, working on some other things. And then I had a postdoc come, Emily Harris, who's a co-author, and she was really interested in this topic and getting to work on it. So I gave her the old paper. You can see what we're doing. And she's like, we need to finish this and get this out. So we worked on it more, a lot, sort of rewrote it a bunch of times over the past few years and involved another grad student who's now a postdoc elsewhere named Sarah Chadwick. And that's the story of this, that we all just got really excited. The things we were hearing from other people, this really seemed to tell a story that would resonate with people.
Amazing. Have you guys found, like, even within sex research, there is either a gender bias or like a lens through which the researchers weren't seeing this for a while?
I would say, yeah. I think part of it is a lot of sex research is done within a biomedical approach. So if you're interested in a problem with sexuality, people kind of, you know, they used to back in the day, look at it with like a sin perspective, like from a morality perspective. Now they look through it often through a health perspective, which some people would argue still ends up being kind of a sin-based and morality lens anyway. But they look through a health perspective, and so much health research is biomedical. So because one of the tricky things is because so much of our culture and so much of our research assumes that desire is something that comes from within you. It's innate, it's biological, it's a drive. That word usually means something that's within you and sort of urges you. That has really shaped the research to focus on that aspect of it. That said, there's been lots of feminist researchers who have always been interested in and are talking about and doing research on and arguing about the sociocultural aspects of desire. Mm-hmm. But I would argue the main focus in all the different fields that sex research covers has been pretty biomedical.
Yeah, a lot of like heteronormative, definitely, trying to get the woman to be at the level of the man. How did you say that so well? It's like the man as the default.
Yeah. And we see that in so many places. And, you know, I also do a little bit of research on postpartum sexuality. And so much of the research there is kind of, again, like, okay, when is this woman going to start putting a penis in her vagina again? Yes. Like, it's not very, it's a lot focused on sort of, okay, here's a norm, here's a reference point, and women are always sort of too low or too high. And this also is problematic for men. I mean, it also harms men because men often have low desire or desire that feels too high for them, and how they can make sense of that in a world that doesn't even allow for it.
Right.
You can't be too high, right? Could you be a man with too low? Of course you can. And this happens all the time. Mm-hmm. But these gender norms kind of police everyone. But they really have disproportionate negative impacts on women and feminine people and those folks.
Yeah, beautiful. And I think like the overview of the paper is saying that like heteronormative gender inequities are contributing factors to a woman's low desire. Would that be kind of like your overarching hypothesis of it?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And then you break down into like four hypotheses that we break down really nice. The first one is inequitable divisions of household labor. How does that contribute to low desire?
That's a great question. So we have all these broken out predictions. For example, women actually just do more household labor. And many people will know, you know, the Second Shift book, which was really influential. And it's almost, or it's about 30 years old, but it's still really relevant. It's painful. I read it just this year, actually, or just in the past 2 years. And I was like, wow, this could be written now. So most people who know women who have partners who are men would be able to say that these women are doing still the lion's share of the work at home, while many of them are also working outside the home in paid positions. And even women who work entirely inside the home are often still doing their day shift and then the night shift as well. So that's one thing, just more labor hours, the type of chores and work. So even though men are spending on average more time in childcare than they used to, it's still much less than women. But the kinds of childcare they're doing is like playing with the kids rather than, you know, cleaning diapers, making appointments, making sure that the right food is on the table and so on. So it's chores that are much more, I mean, playing can be tiring, but it's also very rewarding. Mm-hmm. And it's not to say making a dentist appointment isn't rewarding. You know, hopefully you have it on a list that you get to check off. But other than that, it's not the most fulfilling, I think, for many people. And it's kind of like the chores people, the research suggests men are trying to avoid. Again, hashtag not all men. We talk also about a few other things. For example, like the inequities in the labor themselves can be upsetting. Do you feel a lot of desire for someone who you feel is kind of like giving you a raw deal? And then if you work to change it, that's a lot of labor too. So there's inequities in those labor. So sort of there's a number of different ways that there's inequities in the labor, and then you recognize those inequities, and then you have to do something about them or you don't. And all of that is time and energy that is sort of detracting from what could be put into desire.
Yeah. And part of it is like, in order to have a sexual desire, you need to be emotionally rested, to be in that parasympathetic nervous system, to be relaxed, to not be carrying a cognitive load of like, lunches need to be packed and dentist appointments need to be made. Like, that's not where sex and desire live, right? So if we spend more time there, that's why we're spending less time with desire. Is that, am I thinking about that right?
Yeah, exactly. And we even, one of our hypotheses about that is also that we know the research shows that women do have less rest and relaxation and recuperation time. And we know that has a cost, right? The more, you know, when you're able to daydream a bit, some of those daydreams might be sexual, but when all your time is chores, that's not a very facilitating day-to-day experience.
Yeah. Well, and especially then when we put sex as a chore.
Right. And that's something we also talk about in another section where we argue that, you know, for many women, it's like sex is something they have to do. And then they have to be thinking about why they don't have the desire. Then they have to be looking up the magazines, how to make it better. What's wrong with them? As you know, the title of your podcast is what's wrong with me? Given the expectation of it, it's something they feel like they kind of, many women feel like they have to do whether they want to or not.
Yeah. And I think I can easily see how that goes into like, I just don't even want to deal with this anymore, right? Like, it's too much. Like, I just rather just not have sex.
Yeah, for sure. Like, why get started? Why have the intimacy if it's going to lead there when that's not where you want to go? Yeah. If you feel like someone's sort of taking advantage of you in other aspects of life, sex is probably not going to be high on your list of priorities to do with that person.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey friends, Marsha's podcast sponsor is the amazing company Taboo, T-A-B-U. Head over to heytaboo.com for their sexual wellness kit, which includes a massager and an organic lubricant to prioritize your sexual wellness. I love that the massager has an optional warming setting, being a former always frozen Minnesotan, and I love that their lubricant isn't sticky or tacky. Their team of clinicians and therapists really thought of women's comfort and what makes our bodies relax into pleasure. Use the code YANB, that's You Are Not Broken, YANB, for 15% off of your kit.
This is the first time I had actually like thought of this, but it makes so much sense to me. You talk about the blurring of the roles of partner and mother, and they do such a beautiful job of, it's not that mothers aren't sexual, it's that the relationship between mothers and those they mother is not a sexual one. And so if we take our intimate partner, our husband, our spouse, and we mother them, we might be lowering our desire as a happenstance to that.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, our culture has a story that mothers aren't sexy. And, you know, there's the acronym in pornography that many people will know, which is about sort of, I won't spell it out, but mothers who are seen as sexual, which is stands against the norm, right? That's why that's a category.
That's why if you have to point it out, it means that we think that they're not. Yeah. Okay.
But I think really we have it quite opposite in that it's not that, you know, mothers can be sexual and sexy, so can anyone. It's more that the act of mothering is not a sexual act with the people you're mothering. So as you sort of paraphrase, that's what we talk about, that it's not that mothers aren't sexy or that being a mother can't be sexual with someone else, but that obviously we're not sexual to the people we mother. And because of these inequities, like if you're in charge of making sure your, you know, six-year-old has socks and then your partner has socks, you know, it's hard not to make the connection that you're sort of doing the same roles. And we argue that especially right now in our culture, there's this norm of interdependence. So it's like, you know, I'll rely on you for some things, you rely on me for some things, and we support each other. It's not, I take care of you and you get taken care of. There's more back and forth, and we have, as relationship partners, we offer something to all the people who are part of that relationship. But the idea that having to kind of parent your partner when really in our culture, your partner shouldn't, it's not that they shouldn't need help, it's that it shouldn't be a one-way helping. It shouldn't be a one-way relationship like that. We argue like, you know, probably we're not set up to have sexual desire for people we are parenting, and for good reason.
Right. Are we not supposed to have sexual desire for people we nag also?
That's a big, we talk about that too. And, you know, we talk about the way that nagging is really, you know, this powerful thing. No one wants to be a nag, right? No cool girl is a nag. No fun mom is a nag. But one of the things we talk about is that nagging is a word given to someone asking someone else to do their job, to do something they've agreed to. So it's a really powerful way to shut down someone's request for something reasonable that they shouldn't even have to request, right? So if you've agreed to do whatever is your chore, the laundry, the cooking, the driving, and you have to be nagged for it, you're the one who's not, you know, fulfilling your role or doing what you agreed to do. If you don't agree to it, you should renegotiate the agreements in your house, but not just not do the thing. And so, yeah, like obviously we, you know, someone who isn't accountable, someone who doesn't take responsibility is not an equitable co-partner. That's, you know, reminds us of, for those of us who have kids, that reminds us of our kids. So yeah.
Talk about in your research of like testosterone and oxytocin, like these behaviors, whether it's the mothering behavior or the nagging or having more work than the other person, how does it affect testosterone and then like oxytocin, and kind of break it down into like how this actually affects, because I think it's a leap for some people to think like the water you're swimming in affects like your biochemistry.
Yeah, well, we're so used to thinking of our bodies as driving our behavior. And that's, people call that biologism or biological determinism, the idea that our hormones drive our behavior. But for humans, actually, if anything, the reverse relationship is stronger. Our behavior influences our hormones more strongly than our hormones influence our behavior. So one of the things we've found, for example, is even thinking sexual thoughts can change testosterone levels.
No joke.
Yeah.
So can you tell me how you did that research?
So we, you know, it's, we're sex researchers. So we have people take saliva samples at sort of the pre-activity standpoint, time point. Then we have people in different conditions. One of them is a sexual thoughts condition. And we ask them to describe, we call it this imagined sexual situation exercise. And this was with former grad student, Katie Goldie, who's now a professor. And it's kind of like a guided imagery thing. So we ask them to think of a sexual situation, describe who you're with, and so on. We don't really care so much what they say. We're just trying to guide them through thinking sexual thoughts. Then we take another saliva sample a little bit after that, and we compare the change in testosterone in that condition to a control condition where they're not thinking sexual thoughts. And we have them think sort of like other things, like social things that aren't sexual, to really control for what's going on. And we find that it does increase testosterone. So there's other people too. We found that various kinds of social situations change hormone levels, which makes sense because our hormones are released at the end of a whole long physiological stream that starts with the brain monitoring amount of hormones in the body, and the brain monitoring, you know, our outside environment.
So it's like a two-way street. But yeah, I think this whole, like, you know, idea of our body exists in a bubble that's not influenced by anything else is not understanding the whole picture.
That's right. And I mean, even things like you think, you know, your body gets sick and reacts to sickness and illness, like with COVID, and but that comes from outside your body. Stress often comes from outside your body. You know, your body changes what it's doing depending on whether it's hot or cold, and that's influence and stimuli from outside our bodies. And it's the same with hormones. It responds to things in our bodies and they respond to things outside our bodies.
Let's just talk quick about cortisol. So say a woman has a lot of stresses and she's got high cortisol. How does cortisol affect sex response?
So this is a really interesting question because there's a lot of different ways. So one is cortisol, we know, is like a stress hormone, but stress actually refers to officially perturbations of homeostasis, which means just your body's changing from what it kind of regularly does. So stress, quote unquote, can be bad, like when you're upset about something, or maybe when you're cold and your body needs to warm up. But it also can be something good, like you're excited. Like your stress reaction is kind of just like a physical arousal, but then we often think of arousal with sexuality, but just more like a physical
like an alertness.
Exactly. Yeah, an activation, maybe. Yeah. So on one hand, one of the interesting things about stress is that a lot of stress can actually reduce your what's called HPA axis, which stands for hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. And that's where stress hormones are released. And that's the part of your body that deals with stress. And so when you're stressed all the time, your body actually is kind of like, there's like a lot of stress. Like we're just not really up to dealing with all this. And so one irony of this is your body might actually, one of the things we hypothesize is that your body might actually be releasing less cortisol than it needs to during sexual arousal, making the sexual stimuli less arousing or less feel less arousing because your body doesn't sort of have the sort of physical energy to do what it normally does when it would be aroused. So that's one thing. Stress can also change the way we perceive things. And in psych parlance, we would say stimuli. So like things we might normally think of as sexual, like a certain kind of touch or comment, or the stress and the hormones might change the way you perceive that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, stress can actually impact it a lot, either directly via hormones or just sort of changing some of our processing.
Love it. I love it. So like, I don't know if this is the right way to say it, but like the delta of change of like resting to alertness activation, that's great for sexual arousal and alertness. But if you're chronically stressed, you don't get that change. So you might not be paying attention to that stimuli as much.
That's exactly it. You might not be paying attention to that stimuli, or it might not sort of encode in your body in the same way as even, you know, you might know intellectually it's sexual, but it doesn't feel sexual, for example.
That makes sense. Let's go into the objectification of women and how that affects desire.
Yeah. And this, I think, is a really important one too, in part because there's so much self-objectification. You know, there's a really great way to make sense of this, that women learn to be sexy, but not sexual. So women learn that they're there to be sort of sexually appreciated by others and bring sexual pleasure to others, and much less about how they can maximize their own sexual pleasure. And that happens really young. We were just talking about Peggy Orenstein's books, and there's, you know, very little attention on women's sexual pleasure as young women. In sex ed, there's very little on pleasure. There's a lot of work by Michelle Fine and other folks that there's just very little about that, Lena Beijing. And this idea that women are kind of there for sex, but not their own pleasure or enjoyment of sex. And that means, for example, a lot of labor. Like, is your body looking the way someone else has sort of taught you it should, or maybe your partner even thinks it should? And are you focused on that, or are you focused on like how awesome this feels? when you're in the middle of sex or when you're thinking about whether you will have sex? Are you taught that, you know, our culture kind of teaches us that vaginas and vulvas are kind of dirty and need a lot of care? So what is it? That doesn't feel very sexual, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, go on.
Oh, I was going to say, I found on Instagram, one of my bigger platforms is Instagram, and like, we can't say female body parts on social media, and like how banning the words from our language and our common way of communicating, how that affects the view of owning those body parts or touching those body parts.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And when I was at Michigan, even the Michigan legislature, I think like censured a woman, a politician, for saying the word vagina. And it's like, there's nothing wrong with saying the word vagina, you know, and you certainly can regulate them enough.
Yeah.
So yeah, so the objectification matters too. And do men feel like they have the right to sex? One of the things that I find sort of especially upsetting is that, you know, the research suggests not only that there's things like rape and sexual assault, but as we were talking about a little bit before, there's also sex with women who aren't that interested in the sex. And so that's something you can do with an object. That's not something you do with a human. Like, you know, you wouldn't really want to be doing a lot of things with someone who didn't want to do it, other than in other situations. Like, you imagine you're having a meal with someone who's like, man, I'm not that into this. Like, you probably care about that. But when it comes to sex, somehow that doesn't seem to matter as much. And I think that relates to this objectification.
Yeah, I'm very fascinated in the subject. And I think especially, I think there's, again, hashtag not all men, but some men who are like, it's her fault. It's her issue that she has low desire, not realizing the role that the partner's playing in it.
Exactly. And the larger culture. I often think like, you know, if you're masturbating, that's sex you're having yourself. That's more internal. That's still subject to a lot of these forces, whether you see solo sex as something that's open for you. And many women report it's not. So even relating to the objectification, for example, we've had in other studies, women say, well, like, I have a partner, so I don't really feel like I can masturbate because that's more for him. But we also find that one of the biggest predictors of desire is masturbation. So there's, when you break that circle because you don't feel like you can masturbate, that's sort of a problem. And then women with low desire, I imagine, are especially likely to feel that way. Like, well, if I masturbate, then how do I explain why I don't want to have sex with him? So it's like this irony and tricky situation for sure. Oh, but there was something I was just going to say that I went off on a tangent, but that's okay because the tangent was interesting.
If you remember your tangent, we can bring it back.
Yeah, there you go.
The next one is a gender norm surrounding sexual initiation. So like, you are saying how discomfort initiating sex contributes to low desire. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So we live in a culture where there's slut shaming, right? So women are, and we talked about that, that there's this right amount of sexiness and sexuality for women to have. And that's the amount that men want. Again, not all men. And even initiating sex can be seen as like too much, especially sometimes women who initiate sex at times the men don't want. Then because that sort of can challenge our cultural notions of what it means to be a man, you know, always ready, always willing, which of course is not the actual case. That can be seen as really threatening. So we're predicting and hypothesizing that that's one of the potential factors, that women are also, you know, partly related to objectification of women. They're not really supposed to be thinking about their own pleasure and communicating what they want. That having wants is seen as a problem. You know, oh God, it's so complicated. So many buttons to like, can we just get this going? As opposed to like, hey, like whatever it takes is going to be great. Yeah. And I think also related to that objectification, we talked earlier about sex as a chore. So like, women are often being asked to have sex at times when they may or may not want it. And when they say no, it's being interpreted as low desire. But because they're less likely to feel comfortable because of our social context to initiate it when they might want it, it's like more often sex is happening when they don't want it, which then sort of again feeds into this whole process of sex is not that sexual.
Yeah, it's something that you're doing because somebody else wants it, because you're not doing it when you want it. Amazing. I think the other thing is for women initiating is like them worrying it's just going to be like penis and vagina sex, which is the sex that's not all that great for her. Right? Of like, if I initiate it, it means we have to have this type instead of like, I would like sex to go like this sometimes. And like the lack of feeling like they can want that.
That's such a great point. I think our cultural focus on penis vagina sex means that exactly that sort of anytime you start, And then our expectation is you kind of have to keep going, right? But even though we know there's active consent, that just because you kiss doesn't mean you necessarily want someone's hands on your breast, doesn't mean you necessarily want penetrative sex, but that's sort of the assumption. So maybe you're like, huh, I could feel like, let's get close, let's cuddle up, or I would like some nice touching, but I don't want to have to say no to penetrative sex again. And I think one of the great things about like queer sexualities is that there's so much more negotiation and discussion about what people want. That's one of the things about heteronormativity, the assumption that all sex is penetrative sex, penis vagina sex, means that like, you can't just say, hey, like today, I just feel like touching each other's genitals. I know the word genitals is not the most sexual word. Or, hey, let's do oral sex or things like that. Like there's such a norm to not be able to communicate about these things. And that is if everyone's on the same page that sex means this. But what if that's not what you want? But what if you still want sex, just not that part of it?
Right.
So yeah.
Yeah. And I think I really like that because I like to, I mean, I think there's such a lack of understanding how to communicate about this. And I think both the queer area and then the like BDSM, the emphasis placed on consent, talking about it up front, talking about it afterwards. How was that? Was it okay? What, you know, what do you think about next time? Like it's a culture that's very different than, you know, your heterosexual. But let's just all assume we're assuming the same thoughts and like there's no talking about it.
Yeah, exactly. And so stepping outside, you know, doing a different kind of sex can be a nice way, from what I understand, from like what you're saying from BDSM folks, from queer folks, from therapists. It can be such a powerful way to step outside the assumptions and you have to communicate because it's like, it's not obvious, but of course it's never obvious. And one thing I want to add is there's really brilliant work by Sarah Hunter Murray on men that, you know, they want to be communicating too. So there's these stereotypes about what men want and there's stereotypes that men don't want to communicate and so on. But, you know, most men do want to be having sex that their partners enjoy, but our cultural norms are so strong and tend to advantage the things that men do enjoy more, that it means that they're also conditioned and socialized not to ask these questions and not to check in.
Right. Yeah. So a woman reads this paper and her mind is blown and then she has to go back to her day job and her home and her spouse. And but I know we aren't therapists, so we're not, you know, doing that. But like any advice for the woman who's like mind is blown by this? And then like, where do we go from here?
It's a great question. I mean, the one thing I will say is there is research suggesting that feminist women are having better sex. They're sort of more sexual than non-feminist women. And probably partially that's because they're communicating about the things they're thinking and feeling about these issues. So, mm-hmm. You know, it might be hard, but if you're recognizing these inequities, you know, you can't unsee them once you see them.
Yeah.
You know, we only have this one life, right? And wouldn't it be great if it was filled with enjoyable sex for those who want sex
and
for those who are having it? And the communication, just everything I've read about from sex therapists and counselors and psychologists, the communication is so key. But there's so much threat and challenge to doing that for people, for their partners. So sometimes if you can afford it, if you can find folks to help facilitate that communication, that's great. But you can also try it, you know, mm-hmm. often outside a moment of sex so that it's not like in the middle of it. Although that also is great. I mean, there needs to be communication during sex, but also at other points, like let's sit down and have this discussion and with a trained person or without, I think the communication really seems to be key. And these problems aren't going to change. They're not going to go away. They're big issues.
Mm-hmm. Ah, I love it. Well, I thank you so much for talking about your paper today and agreeing to come on this podcast. I know we're helping so many women even just hear this for the first time, right? Tell me what the work you're doing kind of in the future, and I'd love a conversation in the future. You're working on orgasm coercion. Tell me, give us a little taste of that research.
And just to be clear, that's work that is led by a former grad student, Sarah Chadwick. She and I are really interested in the ways that people aren't just pressuring other people into having sex, which we kind of know a fair bit about and talk about, but they also pressure people into orgasming. And that can be a problem. So there can be orgasm coercion. And people don't often know how to make sense of that because in our culture, we think of orgasms as kind of like a stamp of approval. Like if an orgasm happened, it must have been good sex. And orgasms are only good. So, you know, it's like if you had a chocolate cake, like what's wrong with that?
Right.
But what her research is showing which is so interesting, is that it actually has very bad impacts on relationships, psychological function, as you'd expect, because it has to do with power. And while some people say, well, maybe someone just means well, you know, they just want someone to have a good experience. But actually, people are pretty negative when someone tries to ask them to stop. So it's like the impacts are actually quite serious, and it doesn't seem as well-intentioned as we might want to think of it.
Interesting. And that's kind of tied in again to the heteronormativity of like, woman gives the man feedback on how great he is by her having an orgasm, and the job of the man is to give the orgasm to the woman. It's not her orgasm. Like, there's still all of that tied up in it.
That's right. I often joke, it's like he pulls it out of his pocket and gives it to her. And actually with Sarah Chadwick, we have some research showing men do treat women's orgasms as a masculinity achievement. And in our culture, that makes sense given the ways we think, oh, women don't orgasm very often. So if they do, that must be something especially special. And that it's something that the men sort of did or made happen, which also sort of takes the agency away from women. So yeah, lots going on.
I love it. I think the other important part of that is then using sex as a performance instead of as a pleasurable, intimate experience of like, if the performance ends in the curtain dropping orgasm, you're losing the meaning of that being coerced or forced or an essential part of it.
Exactly. And if the focus is just on a woman orgasming to make a man feel good or anyone feel good, because it doesn't only happen from men to women, then we really haven't moved that far. It's okay, yes, we're focusing on orgasm, but we're missing still the idea that really this should be more about pleasure and having good sexual experiences, not so that one person can feel good about themselves or feel like they met gender norms or something.
Right. Oh, beautiful talking with you. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you for having me, and thanks to the folks for listening.